From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum looks at the many infrastructure needs facing the Milwaukee area. Then how the host housing program for the Tour of America's Dairyland benefits more than just the cyclists.
Something we don't have in Australia is the host housing, and it makes it very unique over here. And something that brings us to America, because it, takes away that massive cost of accommodation. But not only that, you make lifelong friends and you get to experience a new city and a new country.
And a local private archive contains many hundreds of LGBTQ+ stories not found in other media.
We have all of these amazing stories that you don't see anywhere else. It's not in Girlfriends. It's not on the Logo channel. Zines are kind of like StoryCorps, like what NPR plays on Fridays, you know, but it's in print format.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North. From roads and bridges to aging buildings and buses, the Milwaukee area is facing a lot of infrastructure needs. When taken in its totality, the dollar amount required for those needs is enormous and far beyond the area's financial capabilities. Researchers at the Wisconsin Policy Forum have been looking into these issues for the past 3 years. The forum's latest report, called Picking Up the Pieces, is the culmination of that research, with some possible solutions offered moving forward. Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and he's one of the authors of the report. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about their findings and how they came to their conclusions.
So this is actually the fifth in a series of reports that the forum initiated back in 2016 to really explore in painstaking detail the condition of the most important infrastructure assets owned by the City of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County, and the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, sort of assess where we were in terms of the condition of those assets, in terms of the dollars that would need to be spent in the near-term future to make sure that our key infrastructure is in the state that we would all want it to be, and then to match that up with, well, what do the revenue structures of these three governments actually allow them to afford to take care of their assets to the extent that they should be taken care of? We did it for local streets and county trunk highways and bridges and county buses. We then had a second report that looked at water and wastewater treatment facilities and sewer pipes and water infrastructure owned by the Milwaukee Water Works, the MMSD, and also the City of Milwaukee. We followed that up with city and county buildings, and then did a fourth report on Milwaukee County parks and cultural and recreation assets. This final installment sort of sums all of that up, updates it where necessary, but then explores really the big elephant in the room, which is, okay, now what do we do about it?
Yeah. And I mean, there are so many needs when you really get into the report. All of it takes so much money to just maintain, it seems. It doesn't seem like we're talking about really improving these things per se, but rather maintaining them. When we're looking at specifically the Milwaukee County bus system, what are the needs there?
So the county has a large fleet of buses. There's a little more than 400 buses that the county operates. To the extent that you would want to shrink that fleet, there would have to be a consequence in terms of either wait times between buses or in terms of reducing routes. So maintaining that fleet of 400 buses, the average lifespan of a bus is 10 to 12 years. So in an ideal world, Milwaukee County would be on a regular replacement cycle where roughly 30 of its buses it would replace every year. Well, think about that. A bus is roughly $500,000. So that's a $15 million cost right there. Right now, the county is able to use about $2 or $3 million a year of federal money, but that leaves a local responsibility, if you were to be on that ideal bus replacement schedule, of about $13 million a year. So how do we put that into context? Well, the county has its own self-imposed policy goal, which says that it should not be borrowing more than $42 to $45 million per year. That can go up about 3% per year. So just replacing these buses could chew up almost a third of the county's financial capacity in terms of its ability to borrow.
And we're looking at really large financial needs, not just from the buses, but also what the buses go on. Roads. What are the needs of the roads? This has been a hot button issue for a while now.
Yes. And so we're really eager to explore it because I think many citizens are aware that there are big issues at the federal level where Congress and the executive branch have been unable to agree on a federal transportation infrastructure initiative. And so that really impacts federal highways. We know this has been a very contentious issue at the state level in terms of the state transportation fund and our ability to take care of state highways and state infrastructure needs and to match federal dollars even for those federal highways. There's less knowledge about the condition of local city streets and county trunk highways and the bridges within those pieces of infrastructure. So we dove in. And again, people are certainly aware that there's a pothole issue, and that's common to cold weather climates like ours. But it just takes a lot of resources. This is aging infrastructure that deserves a lot of attention. Under the existing administration, there's been a lot of progress made. If we had looked 10 years ago, we would have found that the replacement cycle for city streets was over 100 years. It should be ideally about half of that. So it's gone down to 60 to 65 years as the average replacement for a city street. But there's sort of this escalation of needs, and the city's ability to maintain that commitment runs headfirst into big projects like the City Hall renovation and some of its other capital needs. So the question is, similar to buses, can you stay on that regular replacement cycle so that you don't run into trouble? And the problem is that in trying to do that, it either crowds out other needed projects or it also runs headfirst into an issue that we've discussed in the show before, which is that the revenue structure that has been established for our local governments here in the state of Wisconsin is a very challenging one. There aren't a lot of options for cities and counties and villages to see the type of annual revenue growth that they would need to be able to do things like be on regular replacement cycles for things that are as boring as infrastructure.
Well, and you mentioned City Hall, and part of what your report looks at is the building needs. We're facing some real needs here, and something that your report stresses is, we talk about what has to happen, how much it's going to potentially cost, but we don't talk about the consequences of not fixing things. So when we're looking at all of these things, and in this case, maybe buildings, what are the consequences of not fixing them?
It's a great question. I think the perfect example is Milwaukee County's safety building. I think the county has known for the better part of the last 10 or 15 years that this was a dilapidated building that was no longer serving its functional purpose. We have district attorneys, very important role they play in a community, who are working in offices that were once jail cells that have been converted. We have the way the safety building works, there's a need to transport prisoners through public spaces to get to courtrooms, which isn't an ideal thing to do. And so we talk about functionality. This building isn't serving its appropriate functionality, but at the same time, the building's falling apart. And here's the catch-22 we often see, because the county acknowledges that the building is falling apart, but with all of its capital needs, it doesn't want to pour resources into a building that's falling apart that it knows it needs to replace when there are other resources required for buildings that it isn't going to replace, that it wants to keep in good working condition. So the county has known for many, many years it's going to have to replace the safety building. That has caused it, in turn, to perhaps not put the types of regular dollars in that it should have. And the result now is a situation where it's time. And really, by 2022 or 2023 at the latest, a building replacement should be initiated. And that's a cost of $300 million on its own. There's no possible way that the county could accommodate a project that large within its regular capital program.
And it seems like the risk ultimately here is that we have a building that is not only not functional at this point, but at a certain point becomes a safety risk.
Yeah. So we're trying to walk a fine line here. The message of this report is not that citizens should be concerned about walking into any of these buildings or driving on city or county bridges for fear of disaster. Clearly, we have not reached that point, though there have been some very notable examples of pieces of concrete falling at the courthouse complex. We are all familiar with the situation at the domes. But essentially, we're not to the point where we're talking about public safety risks. And even if we were, in that case, roads would be closed or buildings would be closed. What we are talking about, however, is lack of functionality. It's employees who perhaps aren't maximizing their potential to get their job done because the conditions in which they're working just aren't ripe for that. We are talking about in county parks, cracks in tennis courts and basketball courts. Nobody wants to play on a tennis court that has a lot of cracks in it. So certainly problems to that level, and just a really, really long list of things that ought to get done that has grown over time, particularly at Milwaukee County, so that we now have a situation where you look at it in its totality and you say, wow, how are we going to possibly manage this?
And how is it going to be functional? As you mentioned, of course, the parks have a lot of needs. We've really been putting a Band-Aid over it. And it seems like we've been doing this with a number of the things that we're talking about. We've had kind of short-term fixes. But what are the ways of solving these problems?
You know, I think this community has to decide which of these assets are most fundamental to our economy and our quality of life and which should be the highest priority. And are there perhaps some instances where certain assets, particularly in the parks, recreation, and cultural realm, just public sector ownership and maintenance and repair and replacement just isn't going to be affordable anymore. But end of the day, that's one of the most troublesome aspects of this, is that most of these needs are associated with infrastructure that is vital to our economy and quality of life. Again, whether that's buses or roads or bridges or water pipes or wastewater treatment facilities. And so a huge percentage of this work does have to get done. And so that's where we really need to think about, again, this question of how do we want to finance local government needs and priorities? And should we take an approach where we try to tackle a big chunk of this backlog at once and adopt some type of new temporary funding source that would be in place for 7 to 8 to 10 years that would allow us to do one major bond issue to take care of, say, $200 million worth of projects in the next 3 or 4 years. Do we want to do that? Or do we want to try to have a steadier stream of new revenue come forward that potentially would allow us to not borrow, but to cash finance and take care of an extra $20 or $30 million of projects each year? So I think that's a key strategic decision. But either way, both would take some new revenue. And right now, that would take not only agreement by the local bodies to want to enact these new revenue sources, but actually permission by state government. Because right now, higher property taxes is an option, but outside of the property tax and the vehicle registration fee, there's no local sales tax option that is still available here at the county or the city level. And other options that we looked at, like room taxes or local gas taxes, those simply aren't allowed under state law.
You also talk about consolidation. What would consolidation look like for Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee?
Well, it's an issue that we think really has to be very thoroughly explored, and it's one where we really need to take a big picture look. We have done analyses in the area of fire and emergency medical services, in the area of public safety dispatch. And here in Milwaukee County, we have a dozen different public safety dispatch centers. Most counties only have one, and it's county run. Now, admittedly, we are a larger county, and so whether we should be at one or two or three, I think, is a very justifiable question to debate. But I think most knowledgeable people in this field would tell you that a county our size does not need 12. There's a lot of equipment associated with public safety dispatch. So that's an example where perhaps if we had fewer, if groups of municipalities got together and did one dispatch center, as the North Shore communities have done in Milwaukee County, that's a way to chip away at this issue. In terms of fire and rescue, the same thing. We have multiple municipal fire departments. Some do need to stand alone, but I don't think there's any question that there are some smaller fire departments that if the powers that be agreed that they were comfortable with giving up some local control to form a consolidated department, there could be some very sizable apparatus savings in terms of the need to replace ladder trucks and fire engines and ambulances and so forth. So those are just a couple of examples, but these are the types of things that we do need to start looking at.
Well, and that seems to speak to the idea of removing assets more generally. But with all of these, with looking at new funding sources, with looking at consolidation, removing assets, it seems like there's been a lot of political pushback. How has this issue playing out in our political sphere?
Well, I think your question really speaks to one of the major reasons that we decided to embark on this series of reports and spend so much time on it. You know, when you see governments that are facing fierce fiscal challenges or that are in fiscal distress, Unfortunately, one of the easiest things to do, and this, I'm not saying this is a criticism, it's just a reality. One of the easiest things to do is push back some of your infrastructure costs. Hey, we can only afford to do so much this year. We know that this building has a roof that needs to be replaced, but we think we can squeeze another year or two out of it, so we're going to push it back. And so that's inevitably what happens. And what we were starting to observe was that this was happening on a pretty large scale, so that a very serious backlog was growing, particularly at Milwaukee County. City Milwaukee has sort of ebbed and flowed. I think the warning signal that we're sending here in this report is that we're seeing an emerging backlog also at the city. And we think it's imperative that something be done about that before the city does reach the state that the county is in, where that backlog has grown so large that it's really difficult to see how we're going to dig our way out.
Yeah. Well, Rob Henkin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you.
Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Henkin is one of the authors on the forum's new report called Picking Up the Pieces, What Will It Take to Address Local Government Infrastructure Challenges in Metro Milwaukee? You can find a link to the report at WUWM.com. Coming up after a break, we'll have the latest episode of our I'm an American series. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. As we approach the 4th of July, that most American of holidays, it's a good time to think about what being an American means and who gets to claim the label. Our series, I'm an American, began earlier this year as a way to give people from traditionally underrepresented communities the chance to share their stories about their racial and ethnic identities and whether or not American is one of the labels they claim. Today, WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell talks to a Rohingya refugee who's lived in Milwaukee for nearly 5 years.
I met Anwar Kasim on a chilly Sunday afternoon in Milwaukee. It was at the headquarters of the Burmese Rohingya community of Wisconsin on Howell near Layton Boulevard. Kasim greeted me with a smile. He was busy straightening up around the office, preparing for a meeting later in the day. Kasim is a Rohingya refugee and co-founder of the organization. He was born in Burma, the country in Southeast Asia that's also referred to as Myanmar. The Rohingya are an ethnic minority there and have been fleeing religious violence, persecution, and military rule. Many have had their homes and villages destroyed. Hundreds have been killed. Kasim describes the situation.
We call ourselves Rohingya, but the Burmese government call us illegal immigrants from the Bangladesh. Whereby we are not, you know, we came there for a long time ago. And since then, you know, we were subjected by the Burmese military, like discriminations, you know, they didn't give us access to education, to health care, to anything, you know, they didn't allow us to do the business, they didn't allow us to, you know, farm there, to grow farm there, they didn't allow us to cut firewood. So everything's, they put restriction on us there. So we live under a very discriminative and, you know, a very repressive government and its people as well. So life is very tough.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Human Affairs says the Rohingya people have faced decades of systematic discrimination, statelessness, and targeted violence in Rakhine State, Myanmar.
When you become a target, you know, for the military, people leave the country to save their life. People ended up in Bangladesh, some ended up in Thailand, some ended up in Malaysia.
Kasim left Myanmar and spent about 10 years as a refugee in Malaysia. In 2015, he and members of his family, his wife, two children, and one of his brothers, were resettled in Milwaukee. Kasim and his wife welcomed their third child soon after. The same year, more than 2,000 other Rohingya refugees were resettled here. Today, according to State Department figures, Milwaukee likely has the largest Rohingya population in the United States. Kasim talks about what life has been like for him here compared to Myanmar.
Before, we are living a very, you know, difficult, miserable life, refugee life, where you become a subject of people who looked on you, you know, spitting you, you know, treat you differently. You know, like no value. But after we arrived here, it gives you some sort of sense that I'm a human being as well. You know, I can get the same treatment, you know.
Kasim says people in Milwaukee have been much more kind and welcoming to him and his family. And he says he's enjoyed partaking in traditional American celebrations of holidays like Christmas and Halloween, thanks to invites from friends.
I feel, you know, I'm slowly becoming part of this culture, you know, part of this country, you know. I'm one of them. We give you some sort of, you know, what do you call belongings, that I feel I belong to this place.
Kasim says he's excited for the opportunities the future holds for his children. Growing up as Americans, he says they'll be able to experience things he never could. For those who are unfamiliar with the Rohingya people or what they've been through, Kasim says,
I'd like to tell, you know, every Americans to give us time, to be patient with us. We are good people. We are peace-loving people.
And he adds that the Rohingya people want what everyone in the country desires, a safe home for their kids and for their future. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Doman Company.
Coming up next, Lake Effect finds out more about the 2019 Tour of America's Dairyland Pro-Am Cycling Series. We'll be back in a moment with that on WUWM.
Bicycle. I want to ride my
bicycle.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Tour of America's Dairyland is the largest competitive road cycling series in the United States. It attracts cyclists from not just the U.S., but also from Europe, South America, and Australia. Typically, a team is responsible for their own organization and accommodation when they're traveling and competing. But what makes our series unique is its ability to offer housing in local homes for the athletes and their team members. This has made recruiting racing teams a lot easier, as cycling teams typically don't have the largest of budgets. And it's a unique experience not just for the athletes, but also for the people that open their homes to them. Karen Larson started the host housing program when Toad started. Ben Kirsten is the manager for the Australian Cycling Academy, and he's here to oversee his team's racers during the series. They join Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio.
Karen Larson and Ben Kirsten, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
So, Karen, when did you first hear about people hosting cyclists in their homes during Toad, and what made you want to open your door to them?
Oh, well, actually, I know the owners very well, and so I kind of got roped in very early before the race started.
Okay.
And that's how I developed the program. I have some friends in California that did some hosting and own some very large teams, and they kind of helped me along the way. So if I was having a question or a problem, I'd just give them a quick call and they say, okay, well, just try this.
Okay, so you were really boots on the ground trying to form this first endeavor. So what were some of the challenges or the logistical things that you maybe never had to think about before and you kind of had to give yourself a crash course?
Yeah, logisticals, right. Well, the first year we had races that were, oh gosh, pretty far north up in Fond du Lac. And then we had a race in Madison, Wisconsin, and I don't remember what I think we had Kenosha back then, too. And so when you've got 10 or 11 days of racing and you're trying to find housing for teams, or sometimes there's master racers that come in or a husband and wife that are racing a little older age group, they, you know, for them to drive an hour or an hour and a half is fine, but if you place them too far north and they have to go out to Madison, it was, you know, like a two-hour drive. And so that was a little bit challenging. So I actually created a map on my computer so that I could actually time it out and figure out who was going where and find out what riders were doing what races. Because sometimes when Toad is going on, there might be another race that somebody wanted to do too. So they kind of jump back and forth. And so that was probably the biggest logistical thing that I had to deal with first off.
Now, Ben, you're with the Australian Cycling Academy, and you used to ride as well, correct?
Yeah, that's true.
Did you do Toad yourself?
Yeah, I did, and that's how I met Karen, actually. So I stayed there and out the front of her house and all around the neighborhood. And, yeah, it's something we don't have in Australia is the host housing, and it makes it very unique over here and something that brings us to America because it, you know, takes away that massive cost of accommodation. But not only that, you make lifelong friends and you get to experience a new city and a new country more than you would in a hotel room. And example of that is I called Karen the day before we left in a bit of a pickle and she helped us out with, in about 5 minutes, finding 9 beds. So if I hadn't made that connection 10 years ago or so, then we probably would have stayed at home. So it just goes a long way to show that it's more than just a bed, and it's an experience, this host house thing, and it's unique, and yeah, it's great.
So typically, what is a situation for a rider doing a circuit or a race series? You mentioned this is unique to Toad to have a host for you guys. So normally, what goes into prepping your team for a series that would be outside of this?
Well, I guess it's more America that has this, and it's one thing that makes Americans great in their hospitality, the way they just open their home up. In every other country we go to, it's just a very organized logistical process we need to go through, and with a lot of expense, and it's hotels and hiring staff and buying everything from scratch and buying coolers and everything. Host houses, they open everything up and they lend you all that, and it just makes it really unique and special. But everywhere else we go in the world, we're starting from scratch and buying it again, and we're on our own, and we don't meet any locals and we don't make any friends. So the guys come away from America with some really good memories and some good stories to take home.
Well, it seems to be bringing you back, because this year you have 26 riders, the largest non-U.S. representation in Toad. So with your experience in racing it yourself and now managing and organizing the team, is Toad always a race that you put on your yearly calendar?
As soon as we could go into the States with my last team, we did. We took a year off. I started a new team with the Australian Cycling Academy, and we went into Asia. And this year we're in Europe and we're in Asia, and we had a bit of a block of racing, and we thought, why not? And it only makes it possible because of the host housing scenario. It takes a massive expense away. It's a huge expense anyway, but just taking that little bit less, and just the stories that they've heard from the past and me racing here and me coming here with my other teams, the riders were really pushing for it. And they won last night, and they've been on the podium every night. So they've got their own stories now, so it keeps perpetuating.
Excellent. And Karen, what do you do to prepare for riders, and how far in advance of the current Toad season do you start churning the wheels? And
oh, I start very early. Yeah. I'm a planner. You know, I kind of look at it like, okay, I'm going to do my spring cleaning and do my deep cleaning. And so I just kind of take my time and make sure that I have everything that is needed. And sometimes I don't know how many people are coming. And so I might start out with 2 and end up with 9 or 10. And so I have a pretty good supply of air mattresses. So part of that preparation is I have my husband fill them all up. Thankfully, we have an electric air pump. And we just make sure that there's no leaks in them, because if there are, we end up throwing them out and just go buy another one, because they're actually pretty cost-effective these days to buy.
So it's not the impression that people might have of you need this big sprawling house with 6 bedrooms to host all these cyclists. It's just
one year we need a place to sleep. Yeah, I've got really soft, cushy carpeting, and one guy slept in my living room for 10 days.
Now, Ben, I mean, what are you as riders looking for when it comes to people hosting you here? Because I imagine most of your day is not spent at the host house when it comes to racing.
Look, we try our best to work in some sort of sightseeing and stuff like that, but it's usually when we get here and when we leave, because we race really late into the night, and we come home and we eat. So we're sort of going to bed around nearly 1 or 2 o'clock. So then we're waking up at more like 11, and I'm trying to get a rest. And then we have to go riding every day. So we're coming back from that about 1 o'clock and then having lunch. And you're sort of packing your bag and going off to the next race again. So it's a tough sort of cycle. There's not much time for anything else. But we try and take a rest day every time. So out of the 11 days, we'll take a rest day and we'll make sure we go and see something and have a look around as much as we wanted to sleep. We're in a new country. A lot of them haven't been to America before, so we'll do our best to get out and have a look.
With getting ourselves to all the different stages, it's kind of all across southeastern Wisconsin, things like that. How does the transportation work out? Are you, Karen, as a host, also coordinating getting riders to races, or is that all on you, Ben?
No.
Yeah, that's the host housing situation stops at just the beds, and some of them in the past, like Karen has got more involved and more helpful, and they lend a car or they're going themselves and they throw in. Our particular host had never seen a bike before or a bike race, and it was just a friend of Karen's. So they we've just got hire cars and vehicles that we use, and they've popped out to a few races to watch us and support, which has been great, but certainly can't rely on them at the moment. They're actually on holidays and left us with an empty house, so
okay.
I don't know if that was nice or silly.
Very trusting. Yeah. Well, and Karen, going back to when you were first organizing this, do you have a particular memory that sticks out of that first toad race where you're hosting, or what big lesson did you learn from that first endeavor?
I would say, well, I'm one of those people that I'm a helper, so I was staying up till 3 in the morning sometimes communicating with people in Australia because of our time differences in other countries through emails and sometimes, well, back then it was Skype. And I learned that I don't really need to do that, that there are time frames that I can do it where I don't lose sleep.
And so that first year, how many people were being hosts to riders?
I think we had about 70. Yeah, around 70.
So how did you recruit host families?
Word of mouth.
Yeah?
Yep.
Is it pretty easy within the cycling community or at least cycling fans to...
Yeah, you know, I contacted all the local bike clubs here. The bike shops around here all let me put flyers up. And that's pretty much it. Yeah. My husband and I both raced for many years. I raced for 14 and he raced for 25 years. So we know a lot of people already in the cycling industry. We used to joke around and say that we had a family of 500 for every weekend, 6 months out of the year that we'd race with. So,
yeah. And would you say that is for the both of you that that's a strength of Toad, that
yes,
there is such interconnectedness?
Absolutely. The cycling community is close everywhere. It's really nice.
How have you found that experience comparative, Ben, with coming to race in America versus, and you mentioned other countries, you're just in and out. What for you about Toad sticks with you?
Yeah, look, I'd have to say it's the host housing makes it different. And we go places and we race hard and, you know, we're very professional and we go there for a job. And here we get to, you know, make a new family and meet lots of people. And they tell us about the area and the local places and take us to their favorite restaurants and show us the best mall and the cheapest shoe shop and all that sort of cool stuff. So I think that's what really makes a difference. And then on top of that, they're also racing just as aggressively. And as I said, they're winning and they're going home with more than medals. They're going home with good memories.
How has it compared for you to be involved in this race series, first as a rider and now as you're managing a team?
It's quite similar. I'd prefer to be racing, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really hard to just watch. You can't change a lot of it. I used to want to continue to ride instead of manage because I was doing a lot of the work and the after-hours work, and it never stops. Once you're a manager, you get on the email or you're fixing the bikes. But I have to say, this trip, our guys have done their own roster and they're doing everything themselves, and I'm basically just doing a bit of logistics and some coaching, and that's been a great thing. So I'm actually enjoying it a lot more than normal, but I still would love to be out there racing. There's nothing quite like it.
Yeah. How many guys do you have on the team this year?
Over here, we've got 8 guys racing. We've got 18 members in the team in total and 4 women. And they're all overseas at the moment. So we've got the rest of the team is in Europe and we've got 8 males here racing. So it's a busy schedule.
Definitely. For the both of you, I just want to leave it at, you know, what's one of your fondest Toad memories? It can be there on the course or off with sharing these experiences. And what would you say to encourage other people to get involved in this way?
The lifetime relationships that we've made, the friendships, and Benny was talking about how it's hard for them to get out and do other things during the actual race days, but they came in several days early, so we had a couple of get-togethers, grill-outs, and got to get to know everybody and just hang out for a few hours, and so that's my favorite stuff right there.
Yeah, I'd have to say the same. We don't get to go outside, but a lot of the memories are happening inside, and barbecues, as we call them, but they're grill-outs here, and that's where all the fun happens, and eat some great American food and some smoky food and a few beers, which has been really great.
Well, Well, Karen Larson and Ben, thanks for coming in to share a little bit of insight. This is something that most of us don't get to understand outside of going to the stages of Toad. So thanks again. And Ben, best of luck and continued success for the team.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Karen Larson is a host and the founder of the Tour of America's Dairyland, or TOAD, host housing program. Ben Kirsten is the manager for the Australian Cycling Academy, which is competing in this year's TOAD series, which is happening now through June 30th. You can find out more at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then take a trip to River West to learn more about a unique collection of primary source historical materials. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North. In the middle of a tree-lined, bird-filled block in Milwaukee's River West neighborhood stands a purple-trimmed Cream City brick house. While the house itself is interesting, what's in the basement is even more compelling. Down the basement stairs lives a collection of over 2,500 zines. Zines are generally self-published magazines and pamphlets, and they're primary source materials that document histories that usually have no other home. This collection is called QZAP, the Queer Zine Archive Project, and it's run by co-founders Milo Miller and Chris Wild. WUWM's Mayon Silver descended the stairs to the archive to find out more.
At QZAP, one of the things that we think about a lot is the vast array of queer stories that get told, and that get told exclusively in this sub rosa print format that don't get picked up in other media formats. And we think about this a lot. We talk about it a lot. But when you have access to more traditional forms of publishing or sort of mainstream media outlets, what you see when you see queer stories is you see, I would say, a fairly narrow view of what it means to be gay and lesbian, without a whole lot of talking about what it means to be bisexual, to be transgender. And a lot of that is, it's sort of based in capitalism, it's based in hegemony, and zines bust that wide open. And so we have all of these amazing stories that you don't see anywhere else. It's not in Girlfriends, it's not on the Logo channel. And, you know, it's, zines are kind of like StoryCorps, like what NPR plays on Fridays, you know, but it's in print format. And so that's what our collection really has become a lot about.
I want to know specifically queer zines, queer punk self-published zines. What is that all about?
We have a pretty comprehensive list on our website of what makes a zine queer, or how we identify something that is a queer zine versus a non-queer zine. And for us, it kind of breaks down in two ways. One is that it can be just about any zine made by somebody who self-identifies as being LGBTQ+. Because of that, we sort of have this broad scope of things.
What is the range of subjects? Like, you know, does it go from love stories to environmental activism to, you know, AIDS, you know, epidemic?
All of that. We have stuff on reproductive health. We have a zine that is one of my favorites called Interview with a Zombie, that is an interview with a zombie. Mm-hmm. We have stuff that is music oriented. We have stuff that is pop culture oriented, stuff that is punk or DIY, you know, zines about how to fix your bicycle tires, or how to, you know, we've got a bunch of cook zines, like, which are basically like cookbooks, but they're in zine format, you know, so how to make vegan mac and cheese or whatever, you know, so really all over the place. But then on the other hand, we have the idea that zines can have queer content and be made by non-queer people. And so sometimes we'll have folks who are more straight identified or heterosexual identified or however they want to do that, but they'll deal with content that we would consider to be queer in some way. So maybe they're talking about HIV/AIDS or sexual health. Maybe they're talking about mental illness and wellness in a way that is particularly queer. Maybe they're talking about queer politics. Maybe they're talking about broader sexual politics, you know. So in that way, those are sort of the two ways that we approach queer zines.
Okay, so have there been any zines that have just hit you that, like, lately that you just look at them? I mean, what do they look like? What do they feel like? That kind of thing.
And there's so many zines that we get, and there's so much that I loved. I started to pull some just to sort of show you.
Yeah, let's check them out.
I pulled a bunch of different stuff. Some of this is things that are very new to us. Some of this are sort of old favorites from around here. So I'm going to start with the old favorites and then move to the newer stuff. So Queers Read This was a manifesto that was created for the 1990 New York City Pride March. And it's this really sort of angry polemic that happened right in the middle of the AIDS crisis and right at the end of the first Bush administration. And it tears into Jesse Helms. It talks about how terrible healthcare was at the time, how terrible the anti-gay bigotry was, and sort of ramping up, especially coming from the Catholic Church and from Cardinal John O'Connor in New York City. And it's probably one of my favorite queer texts ever, so much so that I blew it up into a big art piece that we have hanging up here.
I see in the corner you've got a green framed window with black lettering, and that's basically the connection of this.
Yeah, so it starts with, "An army of lovers cannot lose. Being queer is not about a right to privacy. It is about the freedom to be public, to just be who we are. It means every day fighting oppression, homophobia, racism, misogyny, the bigotry of religious hypocrites, and our own self-hatred. And now, of course, it means fighting a virus as well, and all those homo haters who are using AIDS to wipe us off the face of the earth. Being queer means leading a different sort of life. It's not about the mainstream, profit margins, patriotism, patriarchy, or being assimilated. It's not about executive directors, privilege, or elitism. It's about being on the margins, defining ourselves. It's about gender and secrets and what's beneath the belt and deep inside the heart. It is about the night." And then it sort of goes on from there.
I mean, it's about as simple of a layout and platform.
Yeah, so this is a reprint that was done in 2009. So somebody took the original text and reset it. Somewhere we have a copy of the original document And this was just created anonymously and handed out during the big New York City Pride March. So, you know, you have 500,000 people in New York at Gay Pride, and there's a whole bunch of angry queers going through passing this out. And like, it's just this really, really intense document. So this is one of our favorites down here, for sure. This is another one of ours. It's about making do-it-yourself sex toys. And because there's a real big crossover in zine community with do-it-yourself communities and this real desire to sidestep capitalism and consumerism in a lot of different ways. And so I feel like this is a really good representation of that. Like, it's super queer, it's sex positive, it's about do-it-yourself. And so it really is something that we sort of cherish and we talk about a lot.
And I see that this is kind of a funky neon green with some cool lettering. It says, the title is basically not able to be read on the radio, but I'm sure the content is interesting and looks like there's some illustrations and text here.
Yeah, and how to create harnesses and straps and
anything you could need.
Yeah, basically tools. So the next one that I pulled is kind of one of my personal, I don't want to say obsessions, but I'm super, super curious about it because it's GMS Headbanger is the title, and it's the newsletter for the Chicago Gay Metal Society. And from the best that I can tell, at some point in the 1990s, there was this group of gay men who would get together and they were metalheads. And like, that was sort of their subculture, which is sidestep or askew from sort of the queer punk culture that a lot of zines come out of.
It definitely intersects.
Yeah.
Punk and metal are adjacent.
But when I think of metalheads, I think of sort of the straight dudes who hung out in parking lots and smoked terrible menthol cigarettes and would call us and like were, you know, super, super angry and, you know, anti-gay, basically.
Macho.
Yep. And so this is a newsletter of guys who are super into metal, and they talk about going to big concerts and hanging out in the parking lot and smoking pot and, you know, picking up guys and like just as much as a straight metalhead would do. And so it's, I'm super interested in sort of the juxtaposition of those two concepts.
They're kind of defying stereotypes, defining a box that they, some people put them in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've got, it kind of looks like a Kiss, you know, kind of like front cover with.
The band is called Fight.
Yeah.
In here they, you know, they have barbecues. It's like any other social group, except that they're metalheads and that's what brings them together. And they're, you know, they're gay dudes. It's just this super, super interesting artifact. And this is not a story that you would see in music press. Like if you looked at music press at the time, Rolling Stone or Spin, they're not going to talk about a group of gay metalheads. And if you were to read Out Magazine or The Advocate, you know, they're not going to necessarily talk about a whole bunch of metal, especially if most of their, you know, base, the people who are buying their magazines, are interested in house music or disco or EDM or whatever. So, like, it's these stories that I feel like QZAP is really, really good at seeking out and preserving and, you know, trying to give a little bit of lift or voice to.
How much of this archive and of the zines that you have is connection to the past, to things that have, important things that have happened in history?
So zines are primary documents, and oftentimes I think that zines are made to process what's going on around you. I, like Milo, got my start in zines in the early 1990s, and for me it was definitely about, I wanted to talk about things that I wasn't seeing in the world, and or things that I was seeing that were problematic is probably much more accurate. And we respond, I think, to historical events, like whether they're things that we participate in or self-produce. Some of my favorite zines in the collection end up documenting events that I attended or that I heard about but couldn't afford to get to. And the idea that there's a record of that, that we can go back and kind of touch that, and also, too, to share that. So zines have this cross-generational power that a lot of other, I think, sort of subcultures don't. There really is, there's no age limit. I've known zinesters who are in their 70s, even when I was in my 20s. And now that I'm sort of in my early 50s, like I'm sort of in this, you know, sort of elder position where I was making zines 25 years ago or more. And what I'm helping to do, especially through my role at QZAP, is to interpret what zines documented from that time and making it accessible to people today who didn't live through that time. In fact, a lot of the people who look at our collections or are coming to do research in zines probably weren't part of any of the movements or the events or anything from the 80s or 90s. And it's a great place for them to sort of have kind of an unvarnished look at what people felt in the moment about those events. And that's one of the, I think, most powerful. I'm a historian by my education. And to me, that's the primary documents and the things that people create themselves to mark their own time in the world are the most powerful historical documents of all. And that's, again, what zines represent to me, at least.
So I guess my last question is, what zines have come in that you feel are going to be the zines that you turn to document what's going on today, like in 20 years or something like that? Are there any issues or any zines or any connections that you've had that are very on point with modern issues?
Yeah, we have a zine called Out, and it addresses the boycott, divest, and sanctions against Israel and Palestine. And it's written by a bunch of Jewish women here in the States. But it's really, you know, like that's a really contemporary issue. And these queer women are taking on this in a very, very specific way. We have also sort of from a religious perspective, we have a zine called State of the Gay at Harding University. And Harding University is a Christian religious institution of higher ed where the students who go there sign an honor code, and there are no lesbian and gay students on campus, they said with their rolling their eyes. But clearly there are. And so, you know, so we have people taking that on. We have stuff that documents queer perspectives on the immigration crisis that's happening here in the States right now, and, you know, how we have this duty to stand up and say, you know, what we're doing with these kids and with these families is absolutely atrocious. And, you know, so that's getting documented in zines that we get kind of on the regular. You know, seeing this real explosion of gender in the best possible way is a real contemporary issue. You know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, some folks in the queer community were talking about trans issues, but not at all to the extent that we are now. You know, we didn't have focal points in the same way that we did. And so we're seeing that in zines. And I think that if we look back in 20 years, we'll be like, oh yeah, you know, the zine folks were doing that. And then suddenly more and more folks were doing that. And, you know, we have this really sort of rich, cool history that is existing.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Milo.
Thank you.
Milo Miller and Chris Wild co-founded QZAP, the Queer Zine Archive Project, and they run it from their home in River West. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Ben Benversi, Zoe Munson, Cassidy Schrader, and Allison Dukanovich. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Taryn Powell this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our audio engineer, and Michelle Madernowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.